translation. The demigod said, "Let Maharaj Nimi live without a material body. Let him live in a spiritual body as a personal associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And, according to his desire, let him be manifest or unmanifest to common materially embodied people." Purport. The demigods wanted Maharaj Nimi to come to life, but Maharaj Nimi did not want to accept another material body. Under the circumstances, the demigods, having been requested by the saintly persons, gave him the benediction that he would be able to stay in his spiritual body. There are two kinds of spiritual bodies, as generally understood by common men. The term spiritual body is sometimes taken to refer to a ghostly body. An impious man who dies after sinful activities is sometimes condemned so that he cannot possess a gross material body of five material elements, but must live in a subtle body of mind, intelligence, and ego. However, as explained in Bhagavad Gita, devotees can give up the material body and attain a spiritual body free from all material tinges, gross and subtle. Chyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mam iti sorjuna. Thus the demigods gave King Nimi the benediction that he would be able to stay in a purely spiritual body, free from all gross and subtle material contamination. The Supreme Personality of Godhead can be seen or unseen according to his own transcendental desire. Similarly, a devotee being Jivan Mukta can be seen or not, as he chooses. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, Naham Prakasya Sarvasya Yoga Maya Samavritaha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna is not manifest to everyone and anyone. To the common man, he is unseen. Ata Sri Krishna Namadi Nabhavet Grahyam Indriye. Krishna and his name, fame, qualities and paraphernalia cannot be materially understood. Unless one is advanced in spiritual life, Sevan Mukhehi Jivado, one cannot see Krishna. Therefore, the ability to see Krishna depends on Krishna's mercy. The same privilege of being seen or unseen according to one's own desire was given to Maharaj Nimi. Thus he lived in his original spiritual body as an associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Tamagyana tamrindasyakinanchana shalakya chakshur humilitamina tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born blinded by the darkness of ignorance, but my spiritual masters are opening my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge, and I therefore offer my humble obeisances unto them. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Srimate Hridayananda Goswaminata Namane. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Srimate Shivaram Swaminata Namane. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminata Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskita Deshtrane. Mukham Karoti Bachalam Pangam Langai Te Garim Yat Kripata Mahambande Shri Gurundinatarnam. Narayanam Namaskrita Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayamudirayat. Srinivatasharya Nityam Grinitas Chashvacheshtikam Kalina Natidirgina Bhagavan Vishate Hridi. One who regularly reads the Srimad Bhagavatam and who is always taking the matter very seriously will have the Supreme Personality of Godhead manifested within their hearts within a very short time. Deva uchuhu videha usyatam kamam lokaneshu sharirinam unmeshana nimesha byam lakshito jatma samstitaha. The demigod said, "Let Maharaj Nimi live without a material body. Let him live in a spiritual body as a personal associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And according to his desire, let him be manifest or unmanifest to common materially embodied people." So we have the two main characters here, Maharaj Nimi and Vishishta Muni. I would consider they're the protagonists of this chapter. Maharaj Nimi is the son of Ikshvaku, who is the son of Manu, who is the son of the sun god. And he's also well known because further on in the Bhagavatam, he has this, there's this episode of his conversations with the nine Yogendras, the Nava Yogendras. It's one of my favorite sections of the Bhagavatam, in fact. And it's okay, I got it. Sorry. It's all right. It's how I want it. So, the nine Yogendras are descendants of Priyavrata. We know that Swayambhuva Manu had five children. Uttanapad and Priyavrata were his two sons, and he had three daughters. And the management of the world was conducted by first of all, King Uttanapad and his descendants. And his son was, of course, Dhruva Maharaj, and so the line went down from Dhruva Maharaj, and it's traced in the Bhagavatam and goes through to the Prachetas, and then eventually the line stops. And so Swayambhuva Manu had the responsibility of, you know, who's going to manage the universe since this line has stopped. Priyavrata originally didn't want to know about management. He just retired and performed tapasya and cultivated his Krishna consciousness under the guidance of Narada Muni. So when the line coming down from Uttanapad stopped, Swayambhuva Manu approached Priyavrata and he asked him to take up the management. He was reluctant, he didn't want to do it, and eventually Lord Brahma had to come and lend his influence, and then finally Priyavrata agreed to do it. So coming down the line from Priyavrata, eventually we get to Lord Rishabhdev, and then amongst his 100 sons were the nine Yogendras. And they had this conversation with King Nimi that was just, it's a wonderful passage in the Bhagavatam. So it says in here that King Nimi is a self-realized soul. He's an enlightened self-realized soul. And we come across, I think it's only one of two situations in the Bhagavatam where the disciple challenges the authority of the spiritual master with justification. There are other actually incidents where it happens without justification. The other incident where it happens with justification is when Bali Maharaj challenges the authority of Shukracharya. Shukracharya gives him an express order and Bali Maharaj does not conform. He engages his free will, his power of discrimination, to resist the order of his spiritual master and act contrary to the order of his spiritual master. But he's glorified, he's a Mahajan, and he is glorified for that. We have another occasion where King Indra, his spiritual master came to his court and he just ignored him. And he was very offensive to him, and then that's another lesson. There are lessons in the Bhagavatam of what to do and what not to do. Pravritim cha, nivritim cha. So that's the lesson of what not to do. Here's another lesson of what to do, even at the cost of disobeying the order of the spiritual master. There's a conflict here because the pure devotee wants to perform a yajna. He wants to actually glorify Krishna. And he's understanding that life is short and I must maximize my time in serving Krishna. So he's got this yajna ready to perform and he's asked his spiritual master to assist him in that yajna. But Vasishtha Muni, in this part of his life, is very materially motivated. And he says to King Nimi that, I'm not able to participate in this yajna because I have another engagement. I'm going to perform a yajna with Lord Indra and then I'll come back and I'll do your one. So he's prioritizing. The reason Prabhupada explains in the purport earlier that the reason he's choosing to perform the yajna at Amaravati with King Indra first is because he's going to get material remuneration. That's the motivation. There's a material motivation here. So when he says to King Nimi, he said, you don't perform your yajna until I get back from King Indra's court. It's very interesting that it says that King Nimi didn't say anything. He didn't say, yes, Guru Maharaj, I'll wait until you come back. He just didn't say anything. He just remained neutral. And so off went Vasishtha Muni to King Indra's court. And King Nimi must have been thinking about it, and he decided, well, it says in the book that he considered life too short and the importance of service to Krishna too great. So he just went ahead and did the yajna, in spite of knowing that it would greatly displease his spiritual master. He performed the yajna anyway. So when Vasishtha Muni came back, rather than think, oh, he's so enthusiastic to serve Krishna, how wonderful. Because the object should be, the common object should be with disciple and guru, that Krishna is pleased. And he sees that, oh, Krishna is pleased by this person's enthusiasm and sincerity, so I can be also pleased. Rather than think that, he took it as his ego was affronted. How dare you, start this yajna without me? And he cursed him to leave his body. But King Nimi understood that Vasishtha Muni had no right to curse him on the grounds that he was cursing him, on the grounds of his ego being offended. So he just cursed him straight back. Well, you don't have any right to curse me. I'm cursing you to leave your body. So they both left their bodies. And it meant that there was nobody left to rule the world. King Nimi was the ruler of the world. So the saintly persons and the brahmanas, they understood the importance of having a strong ruler. So they performed another yajna to enlist the assistance of the demigods to bring back to life King Nimi so that rulership of the world can continue. And they agreed to do it. So they're in the process of bringing Nimi back to life when suddenly Nimi calls out and says, I don't want to come back to a material body. And then it was when I was looking at this verse, I was a little bit confused. It says here that the demigods gave Nimi the benediction. How can demigods give the benediction that you be in a spiritual body and that you... I'll just read what it says, that you be a personal associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How can they have that potency? So I was in a quandary, and I was just thinking, this doesn't seem very logical. And I'm still not sure if I've come to the correct conclusion, but my understanding was that they're not actually bestowing anything. They're not bestowing upon Maharaj Nimi this state of consciousness that you be a pure devotee and that you associate with Krishna. He already was in that state. When Vasishtha Muni cursed him and he left his body, it said already that he was a self-realized soul. So he's in his pure constitutional position. And he's associating with Krishna. He's not. The demigods didn't say to him, okay, you may now go back to Godhead and to Goloka Vrindavan and be with Krishna. They didn't say that. They just said, you may remain in your spiritual body. So he was already in his spiritual body. We're just not going to interfere, basically, they said. We're not going to interfere. We're not going to bring you back to life in your previous body. We'll just allow you to continue as you are. That's my understanding of this behavior of the demigods. One colleague of mine said it could possibly also mean that the demigods were being empowered by Krishna to benedict him with spiritual consciousness. That's another angle on it. What I'm going to explore a little bit now is this mentality of Vishishta Munis, that he chose to go to this Indra Yagya as opposed to performing a yagya that was to glorify Krishna, that was an act of devotional service. He was performing a basically Karma Kandiya activity instead of performing a devotional activity. So the way I was thinking about it is that his mentality is fruitive, and it's the mentality of a businessman. It's like trading. It's basically what Karma Mimamsa amounts to. In the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, there is this mentality that if I perform this yagya, and these ingredients are there, and everything is done according to the rules and regulations, then what must happen is that I will get a particular return. In the same way that in the material world, that's how business is conducted. According to the marketplace, this item has this much value. So if you want to purchase, 10 of this item, then you must give me this much of its market value. And then we can exchange. And this is the basis of exchange. You can actually quantify it. You can quantify it, you can calculate it, you can measure it. And this is called trading. So then, this is Karma Mimamsa philosophy. And it's also the philosophy of how business is conducted in the material world. So I was asking myself the question, what's the difference between that and Krishna saying in Bhagavad Gita, Yeyatam mam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham mamavartmanavartante manusha partasarvashaha. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. It sounds like the same thing. If you take, it's a proportionate thing. As you surrender, I'll reward you. So what's the difference? The difference, it's a subtle difference, but it's a very important difference. That when Krishna says, as you surrender, I reward you accordingly, Krishna's saying that he's reciprocating with the mood and with the motivation and with the sincerity. And the externals are simply the vehicle upon which the reciprocation happens. So, if we're chanting our rounds, then if we chant one round, Krishna's going to reciprocate. And so, if we chant two rounds, does that mean Krishna will reciprocate twice as much? Not necessarily. Because the chanting of the rounds is merely the external vehicle of what's in the heart. So if we're chanting with a certain amount of devotion, then Krishna will reciprocate with that. And if we chant with more devotion Krishna will reciprocate more with that. Krishna will reciprocate with the devotion that is being expressed. Now, that doesn't mean that the externals is irrelevant, because the externals are very relevant. We know that Krishna says, Yogastha kura karmani sangam tyatva dananjaya siddhya siddhyo samobhutva samadvam yoga uchite. Krishna says to Arjuna, perform your duty equipoised, abandoning all attachment to success and failure. Such equanimity is called yoga. And there's many other verses where Krishna is saying to perform your prescribed duty. Because that in itself is a statement of your devotion. If you can maintain your prescribed duty, whether it's success or failure. So you have this vehicle. You may be out on your doing your service and you don't feel like doing your service on that day, but you still do that service. And so Krishna can actually see that you have sincerity, that you have devotion, that you're not just that you're more committed to him and you're more loyal to him than you are to your own mind's inclination. In the case of Vishishta Muni, it was very clear that Vishishta Muni has got more loyalty and commitment to his own inclinations, his own selfish purposes, than he has towards pleasing Krishna. To some degree, he's more interested in pleasing himself than he is towards pleasing Krishna. So Krishna wants to find out, you know, are we more interested in pleasing ourselves or in pleasing him? So this is the issue that Krishna is trying to determine, and this is how Krishna engages Maya to test us. Are we more inclined to please ourselves or towards pleasing Krishna? Do we have the trading mentality in our devotional service? Are we trading with Krishna? Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki jai, Shri Tram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Shri Shri Gauranitai ki jai. That's what Krishna is wanting to see. Are we trading with him or are we doing devotional service? Because if we're trading with Krishna, that, you know, I'm going to serve you, but I'm expecting something back. If we've got that mentality, then we will not be able to continue indefinitely, because Krishna is not our order supplier. Krishna is never obliged, being supremely independent. So, for instance, if we come up to a vending machine, we're thirsty, we need a bottle of water, we come up to the vending machine and we put our money in the vending machine, we expect that bottle of water. In fact, if we don't get the bottle of water, I know I would probably start belting the machine. I'd start kind of kneeing the machine or whacking it and, come on, give me my water. I paid for it. I've paid for it, I want my item. So this is essentially the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, and when it's applied in devotional service, it ruins everything. You know, we have that attitude with Krishna, you know, and I've heard devotees saying, you know, that have kind of left the movement or have faded a bit, they say, you know, I gave so many years of my life to serving Krishna, you know, I was out there on the street, and what did I get back, you know? Here I am, I'm 45, 50 years old, got no qualifications, best years of my life went to Krishna consciousness, and what have I got back, you know? I'm just on the dole, and they got a whole litany of how Krishna exploited them. But Krishna didn't exploit them, but they were trying to exploit Krishna. The trading mentality is always a mentality of exploitation. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that aperyamitastvanyam prakritim vidime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayadam daryate jagat. Yayate daryate jagat, thanks, is where it says that, you know, the The jiva is the superior energy, but he has this tendency to want to exploit the material nature, the inferior material nature. He's seeking to exploit that. And so we could even apply yayatamam prapadyante to that. If someone tries to exploit Krishna, then Krishna won't exploit them back, but they will. The karma will come back to them. The law of karma is like a mirror, and you actually start to get feedback of how you have behaved. So, if we look at the behavior of great devotees, they don't have this trading mentality. They're serving Krishna without thought of consequences. They're not projecting whether the result is going to be favorable or unfavorable. They're just perceiving whether Krishna will be pleased by this or not. The wives of the brahmanas, they were not. The brahmanas in that pastime in Krishna book, they were concerned about their yajna and certain rules that may be broken if they were to feed the cowherd boys and Krishna. But the wives of the brahman were not concerned with any of these negative consequences. They just saw Krishna's hungry and his cowherd boyfriends are hungry. Let us reciprocate with them. Let us feed them. The gopis went out into the night when Krishna called them, knowing that their reputations were now in tatters, that, you know, morally there was they would be sort of considered tainted in some way morally by the social understanding of the society. But they weren't concerned. And another example is Narada Muni. When he became enlightened, it says in the Bhagavatam that he just went out chanting Hare Krishna, and it says that he was not concerned with the formalities of society and what people thought of him. There was no egotistical consideration. He was just chanting, associating with Krishna. So that's one part that I found interesting about this verse. The other part I was thinking about was that he did not want to live in a material body. His own words were, "I do not wish to accept a material body, for such a body is a source of distress, lamentation, and fear." Distress, lamentation, and fear. There's one verse in the Bhagavatam that says, "Pratyavayoba so hyasanto pyartakarina." Evam deha dayo bhava yachancha mrityato bhayam. And it says that that just as echoes, shadows, and mirages are imperfect representations of real things, in the same way, this body, mind, and ego are imperfect representations of real things. And it explains that shadows, echoes, and mirages, they give some meaningful, comprehensible perception of what is the real thing. They give some perception of what is the real thing. The shadow gives a representation of what is casting the shadow. The echo is giving it's an imperfect representation, but it's giving a representation of what is the source of that echo. And in the same way, this body and this mind and this ego is giving us some insight as to what is our actual spiritual body and spiritual mind and spiritual sense of identity. It's giving us an insight, but it's the imperfect representation of